Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
We're looking forward to another great show tonight. We have a wonderful guest lined up for you tonight. We have Mr. Brad Yates. He's an author, featured expert, and an international leader in emotional freedom techniques, EFT, or tapping. Brad, welcome to the show. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, man. Thanks for taking the time out. I'm really looking forward to hearing, you know, your story. Let's start right kind of at the beginning. Tell us about your early memories growing up, you know, what was going on inside of you, where you're from, all that stuff.
Well, I'm a native Californian, proud to say, and born in Anaheim, California. So I used to have nightmares that I was born underwater at the submarine ride at Disneyland. So I've always had a close affinity for Disneyland, and actually went back and worked there when I was in college. So, you know, it's so funny that you'd bring up childhood, because just yesterday, my son and I were in church, and there was a kid in the row in front of us who looked just like I did in a painting that my parents had done of me when I was a young boy. And I used to draw, I still draw, I illustrated my children's book. But this was a painting that was done of me drawing a picture. And I had on jeans and this red plaid shirt. And here's this little freckle-faced kid in front of me who looked just like that, in the same outfit, the jeans, the red plaid shirt, and drawing. And he was drawing pictures that looked a little bit like what I had drawn. It was just this weird flashback to my childhood. And I sat there thinking, you know, what would I say to myself if I, you know, if this was me at that age? And, you know, now at this point, even though I've been through trials and tribulations, I would probably tell myself, just go with the flow. Don't change a thing. Because it works out.
You know, that's wild, Brad, because, I mean, just right here at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that this could go a whole nother direction. You know, I mean, that's a whole show upon itself, you know, the things we talk about. Tell me about, I mean, did you have siblings growing up? What was the family like, you know, nurturing at home?
My dad at that time was traveling. It had, we moved around a bit. So we were only in Anaheim for a short while, and then we moved to different places. I had an older sister at first, and then eventually I had three younger sisters. Mm-hmm. We're all about 2 years apart. So there's five of us. I'm number two, and I'm the only boy, which was interesting because, you know, I think my mom, you know, therefore I had to be the, you know, very manly, and I was just not a great athlete. I was not quite the macho, I was okay, but I was not, I was no sports star. But so we moved around a bit. And as I said, we lived in Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania for a while. That's where my next sister was born. And then the next one was born in the Bay Area, San Francisco area. And then the last one was born in Los Angeles, right about the time of the big earthquake in 1971. So moved up and down the coast a lot when I was growing up, and then, you know, I had a good childhood.
Yeah,
you know, it was you know, as far as I can remember. But when I was 15, though, it was the living with all these women was was a bit much. And I, you know, I had an opportunity then to go away to boarding school, and I went to the same boarding school my dad did then in Southern California. Very small, 50 students in my graduating class, very tiny prep school. And so during my high school years, I was away from home, and that was a great experience.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You mentioned something, being the only male sibling, and, you know, you said that you had to be manly. I mean, like that, did that, well, and I understand that, but did that come looking back today and from all the things that you've learned about yourself and what you do, is it, I mean, it was a lot of that like perceived, you just kind of thought that, or were they always telling you, you protect your sisters and you got, you're the man of the house, or, you know, that we talk about that on the show, how these things, how those early imprinting, tell us about that.
Yeah. You know, and I don't recall being told specifically, more a matter of, guiding, you know, trying to, inspire interest in certain things. And, you know, and I don't, I can't say I was really pushed, but, you know, but I was, there were definitely, and again, I don't remember specific messages about this, but there was the suggestion that, you know, guys don't cry and that kind of stuff, you know, and I say this without any blame towards my parents. Right. They're, you know, products of their own programming, you know, did an incredible, you know, were and are fantastic parents, but a lot of stuff comes in and that definitely, you know, is an issue. So to, you know, to now be an expert in emotional freedom techniques when emotional freedom was not exactly my my forte as a child or in my high school years. So,
well, Brad, that always just blows my mind. You know, looking at myself and from what I can remember, and like you said, there's no blame here. It's the, I don't know if it's social imprinting, but those formidable years. I mean, we, and you said it, programming. You know, we. Yeah. We get programmed, and that certainly has an effect on the outcome of the rest of our lives and our decision making and our freedom, I imagine. So.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I wrote the children's book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you know,
get them when they're
young. Saving, you know, and I, when I'm working with clients, I'm always saying, you know, try to take the blame off parents while recognizing, you know, the part that they played. Mm-hmm. But, you know, recognizing that, you know, everything my parents did was in my best interest as far as they knew.
Sure. Tell me, now you mentioned that in the church the other day when you saw that, you saw you there and drawing. So you had a pretty, did you have an early like dream or was your heart tugging on you? Did you know you had a gift of drawing? Did you recognize any of that or nurture that along or that kind of just was there?
You know, I was always good at drawing. But it wasn't something, I mean, it was just something I just kind of did. And I didn't, you know, I don't think I really had any dreams of being an artist when I grew up.
Okay.
I, you know, the only job I recall as a child saying, this is what I want to do when I grow up is, was to be a zookeeper.
Yeah.
I wanted to, I loved the zoo and I wanted to go and work with exotic animals. And, that's the only thing that I remember as a child going, yeah, this is what I want to do. And until eventually I got into acting in high school, which then became.
Well, there you go. I just find it so fascinating. You know, some people, you know, guests in the show, some people are born and they just tell me they knew, like, they knew right away and they make all the sacrifices and commitment and just follow their heart's desire. And they have that strong, and other people kind of is more of a, the educational variety, you know.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting that, you know, different people's paths, you know, how that worked out. And again, even not to harp on that, well, I guess I'm gonna, but even, you know, I hear authors say or artists or poets say that they perceived the message early on, even though their heart was telling them this is what they were created to do, that you gotta go get a real job. You know, you can't make money writing poetry. You know, those not naysayers on purpose, but, you know, those kind of dream killers or the way our kind of our blocks get put into us early on, or we allow them to anyway. You know,
yeah.
So you
and,
know,
and it,
I'm sorry,
it comes from the best of intentions of,
absolutely,
you know, a parent fearing, you know, it's the whole thing of don't get your hopes up. And that's not, hey, you know, I want to ruin your life. So it's like, hey, you know what? My life has been filled with disappointment and it's painful and I don't want you to experience that. So try, don't do anything that where there's risk involved as a protection. And it's, you know, unfortunately it happens. So I did, you know, there's part of me that kind of wishes that I had had that that early drive and the thing of this is what I'm here to do. But no, I've been more of the stumbling towards destiny kind of.
That's reassuring. You know? It's reassuring to hear, Brad, because certainly that I'm in that category myself. Yeah. So
I tell when clients are like, you know, I don't know what to do. It's like, how old are you? I'm 32. It's like, at your age, I didn't even know that my current job existed.
That's right.
It didn't exist at that point.
Well, that's reassuring to everybody, right? And that's just that's the facts, right? That's the truth. So that's cool. Now, you said you wanted to be, and I heard you chuckle kind of when you chuckle a lot though. But I heard you chuckle when you mentioned you wanted to work with the exotic animals. And some of the reading that I've done and research, and you know, sometimes our real heart's desire, our purpose, is that one thing that we really don't want to say out loud, and you know, or we chuckle to kind of, you know, block that off. I don't know if that's a learned thing either, but you know, like some people want to be a man wants to be a ballet dancer or something, and you know, it's perceived that that's not a manly thing, or you know, people are going to laugh at it. So, did you ever work with animals, by the way? I'm just kidding.
Well, let's see. Helping my wife wash our dog an hour ago because she got out and had rolled in poop somewhere. My most recent experience of working with animals.
Okay.
You know, I did when I was about 12 or 13. I got to do take a course at San Francisco Zoo.
Nice.
on primates, because I was very into monkeys and apes.
Yeah.
And so that was my favorite thing. And I've had some, you know, over the years, every so often, there's a cool experience that comes up, like when my son was about 3, we went to the zoo and we got to feed a rhinoceros, you know, actually sticking our hands in its mouth. And so, you know, I've had some great encounters like that. It's funny because I don't know why I chuckled when I said that. We always had animals as a kid. I think at one point we had like 22 animals counting cats and fish and everything, but we had horses and dogs and rabbits and chickens. And so it was not, the idea of working with animals was not something that was like, who are you kidding? And in fact, my sister, particularly my older sister, was very much involved with, horses. She was a top-notch equestrian and worked with a veterinarian for quite some time.
Cool.
So it wasn't like it was a forbidden fantasy.
Right.
It's just kind of funny to look at it now, and because it's not something that. I don't know. It was.
I mean, to diagnose you there or convict you on that.
Stop psychoanalyzing me, Todd.
I'm just curious. You know, that's really. I want to hear your experiences. So.
Yeah. No. It's an interesting question. And you know, I think they're beautiful, and I love seeing animals, but it wasn't something that I was eventually particularly called to. It was just kind of it was a fun idea at that time of, hey, zoos are really cool. I think I'd like to work there.
Yeah. Before we move on, one more thing about that early, you know, your early, I don't know, impressionable state, even though I don't know what age isn't impressionable. How were you? I mean, it sounds to me, were you raised in the church? Did you have a connection with God or the universe? And were you kind of right with yourself socially? Where were you? Or were you kind of a misfit? No offense, but whatever the word might be, you know, with yourself.
Absolutely. I was raised Roman Catholic, and you know, it was just something that we always did. It was just part of our upbringing. And then in terms of that, when I was 17, I said, that's it. I have to, you know, I'm not sure about this. And I kind of had my rebellion and later had my own, you know, had to develop my own relationship with God on my own terms, as opposed to what I had been taught. You know, not to say anything wrong with being raised that way. It's, you know, each person's path is different. And so, but for me, it was, I had to get away from dogma and ritual for a while in order to find out how to be right with myself and with God. As a child, I was outside of the religious part. I was always a little different. Not so different that I was an outcast, but I was never, I was never the big man on campus or anything like that. It was, I could get along with pretty much everybody. There were, I was not, I wasn't, let's say, picked on or anything, but I wasn't, I was not the coolest kid by any means.
Hey, join the club, Brad. I asked that just because of self-esteem issues. Some people say they really just felt empty or out of place or can't fit in. And I guess growing up, mm-hmm. you're trying to find yourself anyway. Genes and like hormones are running around, and so it's hard enough, I guess. But some people just really were blocked off. I mean, their own minds blocked them off from other things and other outside things as well. It doesn't sound like you were an outcast.
Not an outcast. I did not have the strongest self-esteem, but I certainly didn't have the worst either. I was okay. I was not comfortable particularly around girls. And that was an interesting thing because seventh, eighth and ninth grade, I was at an all boys school. Mm-hmm. And, the only time I saw girls other than my sisters was at dances, and I was, pretty much terrified of those. It was very, very awkward, couldn't talk to them. And then from there, in my sophomore year, went to a boarding school that was co-ed. So suddenly I'm around girls, all day long and at all three meals, and it was a bit of a culture shock.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a force feeding maybe of, getting used to the opposite sex. I don't know. I ask these questions because it just, I reflect on my own life and, the guests that have been on, and different people are at different places all the time. I just love listening to that kind of thing. When did you know what you thought was next? You're in that co-ed school at that point. Mm-hmm. They were talking to you probably about furthering your education or a career or those kind of things. What happened?
It's funny because as I look back, when I entered high school and it was college prep school, I wasn't sure. I remember at one point thinking, hey, maybe in college I'll major in French, because I'd been taking French classes since I was probably in fifth grade, a little bit in kindergarten. And, I think after my sophomore year, I had or maybe it was my junior year, I had a French teacher that I didn't care for, so I quit. And that's the end of my French career. I took it again in college just to fulfill a requirement, because I was okay at speaking French, and I figured I could get a good grade. But and then it wasn't until it was somewhere in high school that I tried out for a play. And I'd done a little bit with theatrical productions in middle school, or actually in like fifth or sixth grade. And so then in high school, I did a couple of plays, and then it became a real interest, and had the starring role in two plays in my senior year, and then won the school drama award. And I think at that point, I actually had thought at one point of entering college as a psychology major. And then it became drama major with a minor in psychology, which I didn't pursue at all at that point. I think I took one psychology course as a requirement to fulfill a requirement, but didn't pursue that. And it was, and at that point it was, I'm going to be an actor. And pursuing that. And actually as I entered college, I was only there for 3 months when I heard about an acting program in London, a small program. And I thought, what the heck? I bounced back and forth between being this terrified wallflower and being very adventurous. I would kind of shy away from things, and then I'd be in a starring role on a stage, or I'd be rock climbing, or or doing something that was not, that didn't quite fit the, yeah, that's the thing is I'm on the cusp of Taurus and Gemini. So, you know, there's all this multiple personality stuff. It's kind of like, and so I've always been very fond of Kierkegaard's statement, when you label me, you negate me. So I've always sort of defied categorization in that way. Yeah. It's like, you know, just when I seem to fit into one thing, I'll do something different. So I just took a chance, and over Christmas break, I auditioned for this program. And the next thing I know is, you know, I come back to college after Christmas break, gather my friends together and say, hey, it's been great meeting you all for these past couple of months, and I'm leaving. I'm moving to London to study acting. And and just went off for 6 months to study acting there. And then I came back to college and continued pursuing that. And so at that point, it was all about acting.
Well, Brad, you say that, and I'm giggling here listening. I've heard this before, not from you, obviously, but there's a bunch of guests that have been on the show that are like today they're on stages in front of thousands of people. And a lot of those say the same thing, that they were really shy and introverted and had no self-esteem. And yet then they're an actor.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, it, I think it's pretty typical, even though it doesn't sound that, you know, maybe it, from.
It does happen a lot, because for a lot of us, there's a freedom there where you get to be someone else. It's like, if I can't stand out in front of people as me, I can stand out in front of people as this character.
Yeah.
You know, the last starring role I had in high school was Captain Blinchley from George Bernard Shaw's Arms and the Man. And it was like, okay, Blinchley's, he can do this. He can be out there. So, you know, I can be shy elsewhere, but up on stage, it's Blinchley, and I get to live somebody else's much more exciting, much bolder, whatever it might be, their life, and be someone else for a while. So I think that's why a lot of actors who are shy are drawn to that, because it creates an opening through which they're who they really are underneath all the fear. Yeah. Can come through. But and then we can say, yeah, but it's not really me, you know, someone else. And it's, get that disclaimer.
Well, and even the gift of being able to, in retrospect, to look back at all that. I mean, you didn't know that at the time, and you didn't probably, I mean, I'm guessing you tell us, but you didn't write down. Did you write down one day, say, I want to be an actor, or it kind of was more of the process of just what was next, what came next?
Yeah, I just kind of fell into it doing it in high school. I don't know what it was that drew me to try out for a play.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the last time I had actually been in a play was kindergarten, and I did Three Billy Goats Gruff in German.
That's wild.
I'd been a stage manager in was it seventh or sixth grade, but other and that. My great aunt was Margaret Lindsay, who was a movie star mostly in the 40s and 50s. And so there was that. There was, you know, some of that in the family lineage. But it wasn't until as I was moving through high school that's kind of where I found a place that I was good at something.
Yeah.
Other than the drawing, which I had always been good at, but had never really felt compelled to really try to excel at it.
So what, tell us really, Brad, what happened next? And you came back from London, I believe, went back to college and...
Went back to college and still as a drama major. Finally, you know, had some great experiences there. And so I came out of college, joined a children's theater and traveled around the world for about 2 years.
Nice.
Well, I mean, mostly it was local, but during different times we traveled around and I performed in all kinds of exotic locations like Italy, Fiji, Australia, Waukegan, Illinois, you know, some of the really fancy places.
But that's cool. You got to see things. You got to travel around just doing what you want to do, right?
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I came to New York. We had a 2-week gig in New York at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, And that was really exciting to be there and go, hey, I'm a working actor. You know, I'm here on a theater gig. You know, okay, so I'm doing The Princess and the Pea. You know, but
but you've been drawn to that too, and I'm sure you recognize that today. That you've been drawn to children, the children's book. So that stuff was going on inside of you, your purpose or your desire, whether you identified. I mean, I guess I'm kind of just guessing.
Well, it's funny because the children's theater, I didn't know it was children's theater when I auditioned for it. A family friend that I'd grown up with had gone to the same college I did and was now working for this theater. And she said, and I didn't know anything about it. And she said, come to the, you know, why don't you audition? And so I did. And afterwards, I'm talking to the director and he says, well, you know, we do the whole range here from Three Little Pigs to Cinderella. Suddenly something's hitting me. It's like,
yeah,
that's the range. This is a children's theater. So it was not a conscious choice at that point. I mean, but you know, fate had things planned for
Absolutely.
Me, I guess. So, and it was great, you know, and for 2 years it was great. And then I was backstage. We were in Detroit, doing Amelia Earhart, and I was off stage between scenes and just thought, you know, I'm about done with this. I've enjoyed this. It's been a great adventure, but it's not everything that I want to do. And so I had applied for, I think I had applied to go back to go to graduate school, which I had done before, applied to Yale and stuff. And that didn't happen. And then while it was funny because it was like right about the time that I made the choice that I was about done with children's theater, that a college buddy of mine called me up, left a message for me. And so I called him from Detroit. And he said, hey, I've got a line on a great apartment in Los Angeles. Are you ready to move to Los Angeles and make it big time? And I was like, sure.
Yeah.
So that was it. So I went, you know, went to LA to pursue fame and fortune. And you know, it was a lot of great experiences from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How are you?
And it kept.
This probably is pretty personal, but I'm going to ask you anyway. How are you? I can always say no. Are you buying food and paying your rent, you know? And you just said it like, okay, we'll go to LA. But I mean, there had to be some fear or something, or did you just know it was the next thing to do?
Yeah, I kind of knew. In the 2 years that I was doing children's theater, I was living at my parents' house, which is good because I was making almost nothing.
Yeah.
Although at that time it seemed like good money.
Yeah.
And then I blew it all on a trip with my girlfriend at that time to go to England and Ireland. So, and then, you know, let's see, I had you know, my folks were willing to help me out when I first went down there.
Yeah, right.
And I think is when shortly after I got there, I got my first job down there was as a tour guide at Universal Studios.
Nice. That's a good spot, right? I mean, for an aspiring actor.
You know, that's what a lot of people think.
Oh, yeah. Correct me.
And, you know, it was interesting. I was there for a couple of months, and it was interesting, you know, but I didn't last there terribly long, and moved on. And you know, I jumped around from different things. I certainly had periods of unemployment. Every so often, I'd get an acting gig that would pay well. You know, it's like I'd do something that paid $600. Like, oh my God, I'm rich.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
so, it's all relative, Brad.
It's all relative. I had decided at one point that, you know, I'd said, you know, it's the actor who waits tables is such a cliche. I am going to go through my career and someday I'm going to be on David Letterman and I'm going to be saying, Dave, you know what? One of the things I'm proudest of is I never waited tables. Well, then the opportunity came up that I couldn't pass up when I was out of work, and someone offered me a great gig in a waiting tables in a little Italian restaurant in Beverly Hills, where I got to meet all kinds of celebrities, and it was a very interesting job, and that led to other jobs as waiters, as a waiter, until eventually I got fired from being a waiter. which is what I call it was one of those moments that I call a pink slip from God.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where God says, "Look, you hate what you're doing, mm-hmm. and you don't seem to be doing anything to get yourself out of this. So I'm going to help you."
Right, absolutely.
And the circumstances under which I was fired were so they didn't add up. And it's like, okay, this is divine providence. This is
absolutely.
I haven't pissed anybody off enough to make somebody out to get me that I can imagine. So yeah. It must be God helping me out of here.
Yeah. But did you recognize that at the time, though?
Not immediately.
Yeah, but you didn't block it, apparently, because you did the next thing, whatever that's going to be.
Yeah, and you know, the next thing, at that point, I had met a woman who's now my wife, and we were... it was actually kind of funny, because she was the... she was the living counselor for independent living counselor for a group of developmentally disabled men who lived in two apartments upstairs from our apartment. So she helped them shop and, you know, make sure that they got things cleaned for those who had jobs, helped them with whatever they needed so that they could live independently of their parents. And so it was funny because I was waiting tables and she was, I don't remember what job she was working at that point, but she was let go of her position because some very unscrupulous people were working there. And that was a pink, you know, I can look back and say, yeah, that's probably a pink slip from God too.
Aren't they all bad?
And because we had a friend who was a lawyer, was able to call the people who let her go on their stuff, and she got a very nice severance package because they knew that they were severely in the wrong. Yeah. So she got that, and then it was right after she became unemployed that I proposed to her, and then right after we were engaged, I lost my job. So this was awesome because we had free rent because of.
Right.
Taking care of the guys upstairs, we could buy our food we were on unemployment. We were young, in love, newly engaged. It was summer. It was ideal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then she eventually went and got a job. And so I carried on as, you know, independent living counselor for them. And I'd had a series of other jobs, those things that we do, being a courier. I did a lunch wagon thing where I went from office to office with a little cooler on a skateboard with sandwiches.
I see that in movies and stuff. I didn't know people really did that.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool though. Yeah, I just,
you know, it's cool now, 20 some odd years later.
it strikes me that you said that about you took over as the independent living and helping those guys upstairs. Like, is that divine providence, you believe, too? Like, at that point, you already got a taste of helping other people, you know, and, you know, even though you might have done it for what you thought was just because you had to. I mean, I don't know. That might be another topic as well, but I heard that.
At that time, and my wife is very, you know, she has run homeless shelters. She's currently a school psychologist. She's always been, in the helping profession. She had run a homeless shelter on Skid Row for parolees who just homeless parolees. And, she's always drawn to helping those, who've had troubled backgrounds, which says something interesting about me, I believe. very much someone who's there to be of service. And I learned that a lot from her because while I was always a nice guy, I had not been very much, I hadn't done a lot of that. And with her, you know, I started doing volunteer work and she really nurtured that, that philanthropic side of me.
That's cool to hear because that even, you know, the power of example and something drew you to her. And I'm sure she has a lot of other wonderful attributes too, but maybe you sense that all along. You didn't block it anyway. You didn't block it, or you wouldn't have said, "Hey, look, I don't want to get too close to her. I might have to help people." So, you know, it's funny because for me anyway, you know, the best joys are the ones where I don't see coming. You know what I mean? Those rewards. So I don't know if you have any of that either.
People sometimes say, you know, have you carefully planned out how to get to where you are? Say, you know, it's more a matter of God's open doors and I keep walking through them.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's more a matter of saying yes to opportunities, and, you know, and sometimes they don't work out, and it's, you know, I can look back now and say, and it was all perfect in the way that it was.
Yeah. And you said it again, looking back, and that's the beauty. That's really grace, you know, to live another day and be able to look back and sort that stuff out and, you know, be thankful for all that. Because when I'm in it, when I'm in something that's perceived horrible or whatever the words are, it's hard for me to stop and really gather up some appreciation and gratitude in that moment, you know?
Yeah. Very, very hard on our own to do that.
Yes. Yeah.
And at the same time, I'm not sure that we're meant to. Because if we, you know, just brushed everything off and go, someday I'm going to laugh about this and be very grateful, mm-hmm. and it didn't cause the turmoil that it ends up causing, we may not get the same lesson out of it.
Absolutely.
And that's not to say that it has to be that way. It's but to look back and so that we never have to say, well, boy, I wish I'd handled that with more grace.
Right.
Well, you know, if you had handled it with more grace, you might not have gotten what you're meant to. And sometimes the blessing doesn't show up. It's not apparent for years afterwards.
Right. Yeah. So what happened? I want to kind of move forward. What kind of happened that changed your path from acting to emotional freedom technique? Or what happened? Did you end up at a seminar? Did you read a book? Was an angel put in front of you? I mean, really, did you meet someone that just got your attention across a room, your eyes connected? How did that play out?
Well, I'd have to say that the seeds were sown when I was 15, and I had been interested in like ESP and like Uri Geller and spoon bending. I had a mm-hmm. like a picture of Uri Geller up in my dorm room, and I was talking about that stuff with my dad, and I just remember him saying, "I think you're ready for illusions," and he handed me the book Illusions by Richard Bach, who also wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Mm-hmm.
And I ate that book up.
Right.
My copy is so dog-eared, you know, I've read it, you know, half a dozen times, maybe a dozen times now. You know, later Richard Bach would then put together a little book called The Messiah's Handbook, which I have right here in front of me on my desk. So that, you know, it's very much a law of attraction book. You know, which I didn't know about then, but I just found it fascinating. I was very interested. After that, I was just very interested in the power of the mind. Had, you know, kind of toyed around with hypnosis when I was in high school, but not, you know, not very much. It was just a passing fancy at that point. So then, you know, fast forward, and while I was an actor, I was definitely listening to motivational things like, mm-hmm. You know, Jack Canfield or... Zig Ziglar and, you know, a lot of these different people like that, Tony Robbins. So when I was, so my wife and I got married, we had our first child was on the way, and suddenly it's like, okay, there's a kid on the way. I got to be a little more responsible now. So, I started working part time at this social service agency as a receptionist, and started looking at, okay, what could I do as a second career? And I thought, and I saw an ad for a hypnotherapy school, and I thought, well, that would be cool. Mm-hmm. And so I started training as a hypnotherapist, and then I started to, you know, have a little bit of practice that I started to build up. Nothing big, but I was really enjoying it. You know, and it was, you know, it was great for once that if my audience fell asleep on me, that was a good thing. So, you know, and I had this trained actor voice, which really helped me as a hypnotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
So really, really was enjoying that. And so was kind of doing that and acting at the same time, or, you know, pretending to try to do an acting career at that time. And then right about the time that about about two and a half years, when Christy was pregnant with our second child, and you know, I started to really look at it. And at that point, I had an opportunity to meet a really good agent in town, and I thought, here's the chance. You know, if I could get with a really good agent, then things could really change for me. And he said, you know, Brad, I think you're great. There's like six guys in Hollywood that are all just like you that are getting all the work in your category. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, and I said, okay, I'm good with this. I found another career that I'm really enjoying. Mm-hmm. And so I was ready at that point to shift. Huh. And it didn't feel bad. It wasn't like, that's it, I'm giving up on my dream. It was very much a, you know, this is what I'm drawn to. And it was not that the acting thing was wrong, because it was all perfect in mm-hmm. the procession of getting me to where I am. And once I realized that, we thought, you know, hey, let's not raise our kids in LA. Let's go somewhere else. We moved to the Bay Area and up near my folks. And I heard about, through some other hypnotherapists that I was in touch with, about this EFT, this tapping stuff. So I went and took a one-day workshop with Gary Craig, the founder of EFT, and it was just fascinating. I just fell in love with it. And so little by little, I started introducing a little bit of tapping into my hypnosis sessions. And little by little, they became tapping sessions with a little bit of hypnosis at the end. That's cool. And at that time, and when after we moved up, it was a long period of, you know, I probably, the funny thing is, having discovered now what I want to do and who I really want to be, probably some of the darkest times, because I was unemployed for a while. We were living, I was 34 and moved with my wife and two children into my parents' house. It was not exactly the image of success. And really, really struggled for a long time, and until, you know, after doing a lot of the tapping, and that was the great thing, was I was doing tapping at this time, and it really helped me to find myself. It helped me to find a greater spiritual connection.
Yeah.
And then little by little, things started to turn around and started to find, you know, my niche and who I wanted to be for the world.
Did you, tell me about those hard times just a little bit. I mean, you know, you said you use the tapping techniques to help you work through that. I mean, is that what you, did you seek out mentors, other counsel? Who built you up? How'd you stop that negative self-talk and all that doubt? Or maybe you didn't have a whole lot, you know, but when you need to pay the bills, that stuff comes. I mean, a little bit about how you work through all that.
Yeah, well, fortunately, living at my folks' house, we didn't have too many bills. My wife was working, and I was pretending to to try to start a hypnotherapy practice up there. Mm-hmm. But when I'd learned the EFT, and I had gotten all of Gary's tapes and going through that, and then, you know, little by little, I'd get a chance to talk to someone and work with them. And then, you know, I had a lot of this stuff, particularly when I was an actor, about, you know, living in a fantasy world of, you know, any day now I'm going to have my big break, so I need to be mm-hmm. available.
Yeah.
And that was really tough on my wife, who was, you know, working, and I'm sitting there going, no, I've got to be ready for, you know, I can't get a day job because I need to be ready for hypnotherapy clients.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it had been the acting gigs before, now it was the hypnotherapy clients.
Mm-hmm.
And had a breakthrough when I finally, you know, and I think it had to do a lot with the tapping, with clearing this, stuff to where I, you know, finally just got a job. I worked as a legal secretary and, did that, and then had a, you know, did temp jobs as a receptionist. And then eventually we moved from the Bay Area up into the Sacramento area. And I got, again, doing temp jobs, and eventually got a job as an executive assistant. Nice. And for 3 years, I did that moonlighting with the tapping, and all the while building up the website, starting to do, create audio programs. And so, you know, I finally, it was, and I think it was a huge thing for me to be useful. that was one of the critical things, because when you're unemployed, you can feel very useless. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm just taking up oxygen. And, you know, that plays against this idea of, no, I'm meant for great things at some point. Yeah. And then being in the despair of, I'm not doing anyone any good. So I think that finally getting, you know, it was the first time I'd had a full-time day job. You know, I was 34 or 35. It was the first time I'd had a full-time day job that was, you know, like a standard kind of job, other than, you know, being in children's theater or something like that, where I had full-time employment. Yeah. And I only did it for 3 years. But I think it was an important transition to be able to have that sense of responsibility to, you know, to really put in time like that. And at the same time, knowing that was not what I was there for, or what I'm here for. But it gave me stability. It gave me great benefits, wonderful health benefits at the time. So that was a really good platform from which to build up what I'm doing now, and find out what it is I wanted to do, and really create that. And until it was time to move on, and it was just very clear that I got a very clear message. It was, now is the time to move on and really make a go of this full time.
That's so cool for me to listen to you saying that, you know. But you mentioned, you mentioned a lot of things there. You know, you said at that point you were making some videos, you were building a website. Were those things you intuitively kind of knew how to lay out? You just kind of were doing them, or did you have a roadmap from some other people that went before you? I'm curious, because I'm in the midst of doing that myself, so I want to know from your experience. But, you know, did you just intuitively know what was next?
It's hard to say. I'd started, you know, when I was a hypnotherapist in Los Angeles, I created my first website. And then I, you know, kept playing with different names for the websites and experimented with different things. And then I had this idea of doing tapping rounds on different subjects, and, you know, little 5 to 10 minute rounds on, you know, fear of flying, resistance to having money, public speaking. And it was like in 2004, maybe, 2003, I had the flu. So I was home from work and I just sat down in front of the computer. And I just recorded like 20 of these things and saved them as audio files and found a way to have them online and just posted them online where people could purchase them. And I had, I don't know where that, I mean, I'd seen different people have, you know, I'd heard of this with hypnosis sessions, but at that point, as far as I know, no one had, you know, pre-made tapping sessions online.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of an idea that, you know, being open to spirit, and, you know, is that, which is how my work happens now. It's like I just start tapping and it comes through me. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of being, you know, a door opened and I stepped through it. It's like, oh, I could create some of these recordings and called them e-tappings mm-hmm. and put them online and put them on my website. And that was sort of the beginning of my online presence. And
you
then
said, you said that was in 2002, 2003, right?
3 or 4, something around that.
Yeah, that's not that long ago, Brad. You know what I mean? I mean, because today I believe you're labeled as one of the world premier leaders in EFT, you know, among other things. I mean, that's a pretty far, that's the whole spectrum. That's almost from like the Three Little Pigs all the way up to, you know.
It's Cinderella. Yeah. Yeah, you know, and
that's cool.
I, you know, law of attraction stuff, I kept having great breaks when right after I left my day job, you know, it was wild. I took the day off from work. My boss was in Washington, D.C., and so I took the day off because my daughter was going on a field trip. And I offered to be one of the chaperones. And we went to this puzzle factory, this little, you know, mom and pop shop where they make these puzzles. And they brought the kids in, and that morning I found out, I got a call from someone at work saying that my boss had gotten to DC and her hotel room, they said they had no reservation for her. And I just knew I was going to be in deep doo-doo. As clear as I was, it's like, wait a minute. I'm sure that I had called them and confirmed and this and that, but still, you know, the buck stops here in terms of as her assistant. So I just knew, it's like, I am going to be so miserable for the next week. God, I hate my job. So I go in and the guy sits these kids down on a mat, and he sits down on a stool, this older guy, and he says, 30 years ago, I had a job I didn't like. Mm-hmm. And I just decided one day, I'm just not going to do what I don't like anymore. And I swear it was like the skies opening up and lightning striking me.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, I believe it.
I mean, you know, it's as though, you know, God grabbed me by the lapel and said, are you paying attention now?
Brad, it's funny to listen to that, because you had to hear it through a message. He was talking to children, and that's what got you heard it that way.
Yeah.
Real clear and simple, right?
Yeah. And so that day after the tour of the puzzle factory was over, I got on the line to the HR person and started figuring out what the benefits were and COBRA and all that. Yeah. And when my boss came home, I handed him my letter of resignation. I said, it's time for me to move on. And, you know, the way I've sometimes said it is, this is somebody else's job that I'm occupying.
Absolutely.
You know, there's somebody else who's meant to be here doing this job for you, and it ain't me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was there for a couple more weeks to help with some transitions. They were moving the office and stuff. And then, and it was right after that that I had been aware of Joe Vitale, who was in the movie The Secret. And we had exchanged a couple of emails over 2 years. And he was doing a program called Attract a New Car. He's going to do a series of four calls, talking with different experts on manifestation and stuff. And I, you know, was using EFT all this time that I'd been working at this job. I had been using EFT and working with clients on different issues and doing things with law of attraction and clearing it. And I had, you know, it's funny because when I did my first teleclass, I somehow learned how to do a teleclass. I don't know where I'd gotten, you know, hearing from other people doing this kind of thing, and I thought, I'll do this, and somehow attracted an audience, and I did it on prosperity. And at this point, you know, I was earning very little, and I had $50,000 in credit card debt. Mm. But I knew the principles. I just intuitively knew that this stuff made sense. And it's like, okay, I can wait for some time until it's all happened and then tell people about it, or I can just start putting this out there and sharing what makes sense. And, you know, and as time went on, the credit card debt went away and the prosperity built up. And then, but then I let go of this job, and it was a little shaky there because I, you know, having only moonlighted with my practice, it was pretty small. And it was now, at this point, I'd given up having an office and was only working with people by phone. So, but Joe was doing this, and through different happenstance, you know, divine help, I had an opportunity to talk to Joe, and he said, hey, I'm doing this series of calls. Would you like to be one of the guest experts and introduce people to tapping? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, that would be awesome. And it went so well that he had me on a second, on another one of the calls. So out of the four calls, I was the only person he had on two different calls. And after that, I said, you know what, we could go even further with this in terms of using tapping to clear people's blocks to prosperity. And he said, great. And I've got a great name for it. We'll call it Money Beyond Belief. And I just loved that because it was the idea of you know, money beyond belief, meaning like, wow, it's just so much money. But also the idea of it's the money that's possible beyond your current beliefs.
Right.
You know, this is what you believe you can have. And so what's beyond that? So it really, and so I've called a lot of programs Beyond Belief since then, because it just really fit. Mm-hmm. And that was, and it was while we were editing the programs and getting all the website set up that he said, hey, I'll talk to you next week. I'm flying to Chicago to be in a film with Jack Canfield, which later became The Secret.
Yeah.
So, and so it didn't hurt me that my business partner on this project was suddenly in this blockbuster online movie. So that that really turned things around, and in terms of building up the practice, got my name out there more. And then it was shortly after that that I got the idea of doing videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I created this one. I sat down with my video camera and created this one video that I called Tap of the Morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, it would do a little tapping round that people could, you know, use first thing in the morning to create a great day. And had a friend who did video stuff, and she was able to put it on YouTube for me. And that was it. And, you know, I got some hits and people were liking it. And then 7 months later, I finally did my second one, Tap of the Evening. But by this point, I'd figured out how to upload a video onto YouTube.
Yeah.
And then I did a couple more. And then, you know, now I'm at the point where I often make 3 or 4 a week and have over 300, I have like 330 videos and 4.7 million hits on them. And so that's really how I've gotten to be known in the industry is, I mean, it's very nice when people who are practitioners and even psychologists have said, you know, I love your work and I refer my clients to it. So it's like,
yeah.
Okay, so I must not be a hack. It's not just that I'm out there. There must be something that I'm doing. That,
absolutely. Well,
but it's primarily the fact that I've just been willing to, well, a lot of it is the fact that it's been, I've been inspired to just put it out there. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, it wasn't just, okay, I'm going to come up with another program, product that I can sell. It was, the ideas come to me and it's like, you know, yeah, you could sell this, but there's a lot of people out there who need this.
Mm-hmm.
Just put it out there. Just put it on YouTube. And I just keep doing that. And it's, you know, and it's benefited me in a number of ways, certainly, but it's really the thing of, you know, I work for him.
Mm-hmm.
and so I put it out there and God takes care of me, you know, sometimes directly and oftentimes very indirectly.
Brad, listening to you up to this point, I mean, obviously we can hear the passion, you know, and you believe in yourself. And even sometimes you talk like a little humbly, like, you know, but you've been participating in your own life this entire time and showing up and doing the next thing. A lot of the guests that have been on this show mentioned almost all of them about helping others, and that's really where it comes from. And that's kind of one of the bases of the law of attraction anyway, so from my understanding. But it's so cool to hear how, you know, this up to this point, you know, all came about. And, you know, you must be pretty good at hypnotizing. You hypnotized your wife back when, so, you know, I thought you said I'm not really that good at it. I guess you're pretty good, you know.
Wait, that makes it sound like I got her to marry me under.
Well, I wanted to ask, you know, there's so much in here. And by the way, I want to mention this right away, that I really appreciate the time that you're sharing with us about you, because I'm guessing, again, your program kind of to talk about tapping and, you know, and because it's what you love and believe in and the joy you have and your purpose. But you talked about your experiences leading up to those kind of things and the way you see things have unfolded for you to this point. And I really appreciate that.
Well, it's interesting having you ask, because it's, you know, primarily I'm here to talk about, you know, about you, and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's the client or the listener, you know, and it's like, you know, what is it that, where is your life? What do you want? You know, what, and so it's kind of interesting for me to do this sort of retrospective.
Oh, good.
How the heck did I get here?
Yeah. Well, and it is, I mean, because it matters, man. It matters to all of us. I really believe that. And telling our stories is just huge, you know, because then there's a connection, and whatever people take or however it, you know, it resonates with different people, and it's all a message of hope and that, you know, to share. So this isn't something you made up. This is your own life, and this is what happened to you. And then there's not a big debate going on, and you're not selling anything. I think the only thing you're selling is you're selling something that I already own, me. You know what I mean? Like, it's, yeah. You know, those blocks that I have and have had, you know, really can hold me back. You mentioned, you know, even the money. Like, well, I'm supposed to be working for God and helping other people. I'm not supposed to have any. And those, to work through all that stuff, you know, it's a growing up process. And the show's called Growing Up here, and it is to grow through that stuff and with it, you know. So
yeah.
You've really shared a big piece of you. What about the clown thing? Where did the clown thing come in?
You know, most people, we kind of skipped over that part, didn't we?
Yeah, I got to know about the clown. But what another joy I can tell you now. I can from my perspective that, you know, all your experiences really have come full so far. I don't want to close anything off, but full circle. You know, your acting experience that helped you with, you know, even the homeless guys and the guys upstairs, all those things, and the clown, the children, the acting. You know, it's wild when you see it all together.
Well, in the videos that I do, being, you know, I'm still performing. And
absolutely.
I think that's one of the things that has definitely helped me in terms of videos, in terms of presenting, is I just have a lot of background in presenting and a lot of background in humor. So, yeah, the clown thing, I was an actor, and as well, I was in Los Angeles, an actor, and I heard heard about the auditions for Clown College. You know, I'd heard the jokes about Clown College, you know, it's harder to get into than Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, there'd been jokes about that. And so I heard about the audition and thought, what the heck, you know?
Yeah.
and knowing that it's hard to get into, you know, they get over 3,000 applicants a year and they take 30 people.
Really?
So I didn't have any real expectations. I just thought that it'd be a fun thing to do. And it was funny because somebody was videotaping the auditions for, I think it was for an airline. They're going to show it on, in flight, for their in-flight magazine kind of thing. And so they asked some of us to come and be interviewed. And the girl they interviewed right in front of me, they're asking her, so why are you doing this? She goes, well, my friends have always said I'm really funny. And they said, okay, do something funny. And I was like, oh, man, I'm glad that she got that and not me. Because it's like, you know, when you're put on the spot like that, it's So I was very grateful that was her and not me. And the audition was a lot of fun. And it didn't give much, you know, I filled out the application and all that. And it was all well and good. And it was while I was moving in to my I was moving in with Christy. I was a buddy of mine and I were moving my stuff into her apartment when I checked the mail and got this letter that had confetti in it saying, congratulations, you've been accepted to Clown College.
That's cool, though. I mean, that is.
And it was like, oh, my goodness. And so I spent it was 2 months long in Baraboo, Wisconsin, where the home of the Ringling Brothers, the Circus World Museum. And it was amazing. It was, you know, it was like being at Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
You know, we go in and there's just, you're just playing with toys. You're in makeup all day long. First thing in the morning, you put on makeup. This is 6 days a week. And, you know, sometimes going from 8 a.m. till 10 at night, learning slapstick and character development and movement and mime and all these incredible things. And that was a blast. And there was, out of the 30 of us, we were broken up into three groups of 10. And little by little, they started shifting the groups. And it was, there were, by the end, the group that I was in, the 10 of us, we were mostly actors. You know, they, not everyone who was who came to Clown College was from a performance background, but those of us that were in that group were, for the most part, pretty pretty serious actors, had a lot of background in theater and stuff, and so the performing thing was more natural for us. And then we had, throughout the 2 months, there were different gag nights where locals were invited to come in and see performances of gags that we had worked up. And there would be an MC or a couple of MCs for each of these gag nights. And I don't know if it's the second or the third that I did it with a friend of mine. And we worked out this routine, and I had, you know, over the period, you discover who your clown is. It's not something you just decide, oh, I'm going to draw a picture of who I think it should be. It really comes out of the process and discovering this clown side of you. And mine was this very uptight, bald-headed guy in a tuxedo, a white face, all white. I didn't even have a red nose. I had a sharp, upturned white nose. That I made, and so this other guy was a very goofy, big red nose clown. So we did this whole thing where, in between gags, we had this one-upmanship as to who was going to be the MC. And finally, at the end, I come out, and he wanted to do this thing where he jumps off of a trampoline, where there's an explosion, he jumps off a trampoline. Because we thought we'd do this a bit with a bomb, and I said no, because I was kind of being mean to him throughout. I said, if I blow you up, the audience is going to be very unsatisfied. If you accidentally blow me up, they are going to love it.
Yeah.
So I come out at the end with this trophy, that's this big ball, golden ball. And I come up to him and I say, you know, you are far better at this than I am. I want to present you with this golden MC award. And he starts giving this speech, and he can't tell that there's this big fuse on it. So from behind, I light the fuse and I sneak off. And as the fuse is burning up, he's giving the speech, and then he says, this is wrong. He was so much better than I am. Hey, mister, and throws the bomb over a wall, big explosion, a dummy dressed like me gets thrown up in the air. So when it came to the final gag night, the final night where Kenneth Feld, his son, the owner of Ringling Brothers and Disney on Ice and all of these things, comes to see this, because the deal is, this is how they're going to get their new clowns, is through Clown College. Mm-hmm. And so they come and they this is like an audition, and they had the big show at the end at the end, and I was a featured performer, and they asked Chuck and I to be the MCs of the final show, because they just really liked how we kept the flow going. And so it was a wild experience.
When you're telling that, I mean, that again, I see how divine providence, or whatever you want to call it, universe, how that helped you, you know, and the lessons you learned there, your experiences there. Because I believe, for me, I love to laugh and, you know, joy and in our purpose, you know, finding something that we love and love doing, and just with passion. And I can hear that the same when you told your clown story there, you know. And I mean, I had to ask, because, I mean, I've been told I was a clown lots of times, you know what I mean? But maybe I should have went to Clown College. I'm not sure it was always in the positive when they called me that. But
Well, that's true of all of us, Todd.
Brad, I love to laugh. I mean, I laugh a lot. You know, I probably still laugh on occasion inappropriately. You know, but I've on purpose changed that, where I don't like really laugh at the expense of others, you know, especially when there's pain and suffering, mistakes made, you know, whatever. But that's all part of the growing up thing too. You know what you?
I have laughed inappropriately at times, unfortunately, and it has been very painful.
Yeah. Well, you know, we live another day. We can correct all that stuff. You know, that's
absolutely
what I like about that.
If we expect perfection from ourselves, we're in deep doo doo.
Yeah. I'm already in a block mode. So, what about are you going to Europe soon? And what's coming up next?
Well, you know, I was definitely looking at a Europe trip coming up. I'm not sure about that at the moment.
Okay.
It looks like the timing might not work for that. Also trying to arrange an Australia trip. I've been talking about doing that for a long time. I know there's a lot of people down there, down under, who like my work and have been asking me to come down there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've done two different workshops in London over the last couple of years and really love it. As I said, I lived in London, so it's like a second home to me. It's at this point with the kids are 13 and 15, and I like doing things as family trips.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I hate the idea of going on a big trip and not taking them with me. It just doesn't seem like much fun.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't seem fair either.
So. Yeah.
You guys be in school. I'm going to go and travel around Europe.
Yeah.
So looking at how to make that work for everyone. I'm going to be doing a workshop in Seattle in February and in Ohio in March, I believe it is.
Okay. Good.
So those are the big events coming up.
You know, you mentioned the Australia. I did a radio show. I interviewed somebody from Tasmania and she was gracious enough and asked me to be on her show. And I put it out there that I, you know, Kelly and I really, we have it on our vision board. You know, we have a kangaroo. You know, everybody, I don't know if the Australians like that, but that's always my, you know, my vision of Australia, the kangaroo. I'm sure there's more there than that, but you know, I really want to go in.
There's also koalas.
Yes, absolutely. There's marsupials, you know. But we looked online. I didn't do a lot of research on it, but I mean, I got to get more in tune with the law of attraction because, you know, a plane ticket costs like $10,000 and I don't have that kind of money. I need to attract that. So I need to practice more of these principles that you've been so gracious to share with us, really.
Okay, you be careful about how you word it. I don't have it. It's like, you know what? It's in circulation at the moment, so mm-hmm. It's not there to do. But you know, the funny thing is when you commit to something, the resources tend to show up. But it is beautiful. I had the good fortune of visiting there when I was doing touring children's theater, and I have a great picture of me at a kangaroo park where all these kangaroos are up and punching me. So I call that, here's a picture of me being mugged by the natives.
Well, hey, listen, if you need somebody to come along and help with the kids or anything, Kelly and I are sure ready to go. So, you know, you can always get in touch with me. We're more than willing to help, Brad. I'm always available to help you, you know.
You are a giver, Todd. You I'll give, you. Give, give. Always give. Thinking of others.
Yeah, there you have it. Hey, listen, what would you tell – I want to kind of wrap this up. What would you have told – that kid in the church the other day, what would you have told him? And well, not just that question.
You know, again, as I look back, it's like, I can't say that I would say, you know, make this choice or make that choice. Here's what you're meant to be, because I don't think that I could have gotten where I was meant to be. You know, and that's not to say that it doesn't work for some people, but I see a divine perfection in everything, the way it's played out, even the really dark times, the places where I was, you know, definitely not my best, have, you know, led to a level of integrity that I enjoy that I don't know that I could have appreciated as much. So, but the one thing that I would say, and what I tell everyone, and what I think is my ultimate job is you know, love yourself. Recognize that even when you're doing things that, you know, are not ideal, that you're still a child of God. You're still worthy and deserving of love. And, you know, that's where the magic really happens. You know, and I can't claim there's the most profound thing that's ever been said. It's been said by so many people. You know, Carol Burnett said, it's Lucille Ball. Sorry, Lucille Ball said, love yourself first. That's where everything starts, and everything follows after that. It's, you know, you could say that it's the line in the Bible of seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these other things shall be added unto you. I think finding the kingdom of heaven is really loving yourself, really appreciating the child of God that you are, you know, whether you say God or whatever word you choose to use, source, universe, you know, I'm not here to preach any particular religious thing, but that idea of recognizing the connection that you have with the divine, recognizing that the divine is in you, and really having a love and appreciation for that, that's when, you know, barriers fall down and just the magic happens.
And if
the more you love yourself, the more you can't help but love other people too. So you give what other people need too. So it's a win-win situation.
Yeah, listen, I'm so glad you agreed to be on this.
I'm grateful for the opportunity. You know, if there's anything I can say either in my work or even in my story that can, you know, make a difference for even one person, that's a gift to me to be able to share that. So I greatly appreciate that you do this, that you're doing what you're doing and following your passion with this, and, you know, and knowing that it's making a difference to, you know, who knows how many people.
Thank you so much for that. We love what we're doing here. I love what I'm doing here. And maybe we can get you back on the show to do some tapping. Okay.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, like I said, any opportunity that I have to make a difference, I'm grateful for that.
Mr. Brad Yates, thank you so much, Brad, for being on the show. Really appreciate it.